This week on the Boag Wall Show, we talk about better communication with clients and improving how people view your website. This week's show is sponsored by Teacup AdWords and Full Story. Hello and welcome to the Boag World Show, the podcast on all aspects of digital design, development and strategy. My name's Paul Boag and joining me as always is Marcus Lillington. Hello Marcus.
Hello Paul, how are you?
Yeah, good. I've had a very mellow day up until this point and then it's all got suddenly busy.
Oh dear.
I've been sitting in the beer garden drinking cider.
Oh, very nice.
So I'm a little worse for wear.
I can't really face any more drink. I've had most of Caroline's relatives over for the weekend because it was her father's 70th birthday party and we hosted it all.
Okay.
So I'm a little bit pleased they've all gone.
Yes. But what I've been struggling with, right? So I had an article that I was supposed to be writing today and it's like, you know, I can't work out whether I really didn't feel in the mood to write it. The weather was glorious, you know, all the rest of it. So the question is, have I been procrastinating by going down to the pub? Or am I just taking advantage of the, you know, solo lifestyle that I now work with? And instead of working because I feel I have to, I wait until I'm most productive to work.
I think you're just probably not fancying it and thought you'd just go for a pint.
Yeah, I think that's probably right.
Well, no, but you could say that you needed a change of scenery to get inspiration.
Yeah, that sounds good. It is true, Mike. I mean, it's funny. I've discovered that, because obviously when I was working with Headscape, you know, there were other people involved. And so you had to kind of keep some kind of sociable hours and work when other people were working. But I've since discovered that actually I seem to work best in the evening. And I get a load more done when I'm working in the evening than I do when I'm working in the day.
I used to be like that, but not anymore. I think it's...
Well, you go to bed at 9 now, don't you?
Well, 10, certainly. But I think it's... I used to stay up late because I had little kids, like 10, 20 years ago, and it was the only time that I kind of got to myself. So I sort of called myself a night owl, but now they've kind of flown the nest, as the saying goes. I just sort of like think, well, I'll go to bed, read a book. I'm getting old, aren't I? Well, but I get the most done if I've got loads to do, because what I used to do back in, say, 10 years ago, if I had like I've got to get this done, I've got to finish this proposal and all this kind of thing, I'd stay up until 2 or 3 in the morning getting it done. Now what I do is go to bed at 9 and get up at 5 and I get loads done in that sort of like 5, half past 5 up until 9 a.m. when everyone logs on.
Yeah,
so it's the same thing, just the other way around.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's actually it's not a problem when I've got loads to do. You know, I just crack on and do it. It's times like this where I've got stuff I should do, but if I put it off to tomorrow, it's not the end of the world. And then the sun's shining and it's dreadful, isn't it?
I'm dreadful at play. If I've got a week to do something, then I'll leave it till the half day with one to go. I've always been like that.
And I never used to be like that, but I've become like that more recently. It's like la 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 la.
Yeah, I used to do my homework. I didn't do it on Sunday evenings. I did it on the way to school on Monday morning.
Oh, that is terrible. See, I had to do it. I always had to do it as soon as I got home from school. Otherwise, I'd just spend the rest of the weekend worrying about it. But that seems to have changed. Life changes. You get older.
I had a mate that did that. Ian Samways, he always used to do on Fridays as well. It's just like, just I can't comprehend that. You know, you'd come home from school on a Friday.
Yeah, no, that's homework. What I would do. Yeah,
it's just insane. It's like, no, how can you do that? But I was always insanely jealous that it was done.
Yeah, see, yeah. It's a way
I'm
to
not
be.
As bad as I used. I'm painting myself out to be more of a rebel than I actually am or was. But yeah, I am a bit of a kind of, oh, it'll be all right. I'll do it tomorrow. It'll be fine.
Yeah. But my trouble is I've got this tendency of going, oh yeah, I'll do it tomorrow, it'll be fine. And then I feel guilty that I haven't done it, which is precisely what I'm doing now. It's like, and you end up ruining, I had a lovely time down the pub, although I had to come back and do this stupid ass podcast with you. That ruined it. That's brought me back to reality.
We could have done this morning, Paul. That would have been fine.
Well, we should have done it when I was at the pub. That would have been even better. Although I wouldn't have been quite as far gone. Am I holding it together quite well?
You don't sound tipsy or anything like that, so I think you'll probably get away with it.
Yeah, it wasn't too bad, to be honest. I only had a couple.
Oh, you'd be all right. I haven't had any. None at all.
Stone Cold Sober. The biggest problem I have with drinking in a beer garden in the sun is it makes me sleepy.
Well, you get any lunchtime drinking.
Yeah,
especially
that's it
if
now.
It accompanies lunch as well. That's it. Come back. Again, sign of age.
Yeah.
To fight my way through it. So I tend to not bother with having a drink at lunchtime.
Yeah. Yes. Right. Let's talk about our first sponsor and then we'll get into actually, you know, web design related stuff, which would be good. So our first sponsor is obviously Full Story, who've been supporting the whole show. And as you have gathered by whole show, whole season. And as you've gathered by this point, I'm a huge fan of. An interesting thing has come up recently. For some reason, I've found myself talking about Full Story a lot recently with various people, which is a bit strange considering they're not actually paying me to off of the show. But it's like, I mean, constant podcast mode. Have you heard of Full Story? An excellent analytics tool. No. It seemed relevant a couple of times recently, so I've been talking about it. And the reoccurring response I get every time I seem to explain Full Story, and I'm just wondering whether some of the people listening to this show kind of fall into the same category, which is that, oh yeah, we use ... to record and watch sessions back, right? So it's like, they go, oh, well, we've already got this product or that product that does the same thing. But no, you're wrong. It doesn't do the same thing at all. Full Story is more than just a screen recorder. And this is the thing that I need to get across to people. And when I, you know, when I pin them against the wall and say, no, you're not understanding me. That's, you know, that's what I'm getting at. So it doesn't just record sessions. It records the whole of the DOM. Right. So everything that's happening in the document object model, it's recording. And that means that, A, if you do support and you're trying to support customers, you can see exactly the error message they've got, how they've got that error message. You can even inspect the code to understand what went wrong behind the screen, which is incredible. But also, and in my opinion, more importantly, because I don't care about support, I don't support people. But more importantly, you can also query absolutely any item in the DOM to see how people are interacting with it without having to first add an event handler to kind of track that particular thing. So I'll give you an example of what I mean, right? I was watching a video and I noticed that a person clicked on an element in my web page which was not clickable. Right. And I was just watching a video of some other user session. You know, it was nothing. I wasn't looking for that particular problem, but I noticed it as I was watching the video back. And I wondered, oh, I wonder whether anybody else did that. Now, with a lot of other apps, I'd need to now go in and tag that particular element as I want to track this. I want to know what's happening so I can then filter all of the user sessions where a user clicked on that item. But with Full Story, because it's recorded the whole DOM, I can instantly go and look at any video of anybody that ever clicked on that particular element, even though it was non-clickable. And I could look at it straight away and realize, hang on a minute, I've got a problem here because a lot of other users are doing the same thing as this one user. Make sense?
Yep.
So that is totally different. And let me be clear on that. There we go.
I wasn't one of those people that was claiming I used something.
No, I'm not blaming you, Marcus. Marcus, I would never blame you. Okay, so you can sign up today and see for yourself and see if you get... you can actually try this and see how it's different from a normal screen recorder. You get a whole month absolutely free. And then after that, you can either... sign up, obviously, and pay for the service, or you can continue free, but it'll only record 1,000 sessions per month. And trust me, as somebody that has just hit my limit of the number of sessions I get on my plan, you'll want to pay, because you can't live without this thing. I'm getting all twitchy now because I can't go in and see what people are doing on my site. Well, I can. I could look at Google Analytics, but who wants to look at that? Anyway, if you want to sign up and have a go, it's fullstory.com/BOAG, B-O-A-G. So there you go. Now, here's an interesting one, talking of sponsors. Because our first speaker on today's show is actually the guy that runs our second sponsor, which is Teacup AdWords and Teacup Analytics. So he's the guy that runs behind it. Ooh. And he was saying, well, would it be a bit weird if I kind of submitted a talk, because I'd really like to submit a talk? And I was like, no. I mean, I ideally don't kind of, as I've said to everybody, don't turn it into a big, you know, promotion for your product or your service or whatever. But yeah, he hasn't. In fact, he hasn't even talked about analytics or AdWords. So he's actually talking about something completely different. So he took what I said somewhat to the extreme. So Dean is the guy. So he's the founder of Teacup Analytics, you'll hear about in a little bit of a while. He's South African, but he spent time in the US and is also currently, I think, in Israel. And he's a bit of a kind of serial entrepreneur, as you can hear. He's going to talk about one of his previous applications that he sold to GoDaddy, which was an email newsletter management software. But obviously now he does TCAP Analytics. So what he's going to talk about is writing the perfect email, which is really interesting. I mean, he's focusing on customer support and customer agents and that kind of thing. But actually, I think what he's got to say is much more wide-ranging and has got much broader applications than what he applies. But we'll talk about that afterwards. First of all, check out what Dean has got to say.
Hi, my name is Dean Levitt, and I'd like to chat to you about writing the perfect email. First, let me tell you a little bit about myself and why I care so much about email. I used to be an owner of an email newsletter platform called Mad Mimi, which was acquired by GoDaddy in 2014. During that time, I wrote a little under 200,000 emails to customers and clients, and I trained dozens more on how to write their own beautiful emails. We had an amazing net promoter score, and some years we would have over 5,000 unsolicited testimonials to our customer support quality, and we only offered customer support via email. Most of the questions we dealt with were your typical customer support stuff. Why isn't this working? How do I do that? Or please just give me general marketing advice. These are the kind of emails everyone deals with every day, whether you are a web designer dealing with your small business clients, or whether you're in an office dealing with colleagues or people in different departments. Email is a major form of communication. Every day we write dozens of them, and yet it's something that we do so poorly. When I challenge people and why they write emails that are terse, sound kind of grumpy, or just plain send the wrong message entirely, well, they tell me that they're busy. Fact is, a waiter in a restaurant's busy too. And yet when you sit down and that waiter is engaging with you, you expect them to be polite, to engage with you, to listen to what you're saying, and in the end, to deliver the food you ordered to your table. If a waiter only communicated to you as if they were so busy, well, you'd be justifiably annoyed. So why do that in an email? I consider there to be three lousy emails that we all write. The first ugly email is what I call the busy executive. It's the kind of email I imagine George Costanza from Seinfeld writes when he's feeling flustered. There's usually no punctuation. Sometimes the entire body of the email is in the subject line. The recipient always feels like they kind of annoyed the sender. And when you're that sender, you don't want to impart that vibe. The second type of email is the never-ending thread. This is the one where every question is answered with another question. You never kind of get to the end point. This often happens when trying to set up a meeting with someone you don't know. You write something like, "What time suits you?" They respond to say, "Well, whenever." And then you respond to say, "Well, what about Tuesday?" And they say, "Yes, what time?" And you say 10, and then they can't do 10, etc. I'm already irritating myself. So that's the second type of email. The third type of email is the worst of them all. This is one where you don't get an actual response to the question that you asked. You might get a lot of words written down, but not the answer you needed. This often happens with customer support that answers from stock answers, that doesn't really read the email originally that they're responding to. But either way, nothing frustrates the recipient quite the same as a simple question that is left unanswered. Well, I'm going to show you some steps to avoid all of these. Before we get to my five-step process, we've got to start with building a foundation. And this foundation is empathy. When a client or a colleague or a customer writes to you, you have to think about their mindset. What is their motivation for reaching out? Did they have an issue and they're kind of cranky about the whole thing? Are they just curious and looking to learn from you? Sometimes clients will write emails because they're simply scared. They feel a little bit out of their depth with whatever is bothering them and they're looking for reassurance. Whatever their motivation is, it's usually fairly easy to glean from the tone of the email and the subject matter. And because they're writing to you as the expert, you should be able to figure this out. Where most people fall down is in not caring about the motivation of the writer. This often goes awry in a crisis. When someone writes to you stressed out because something's gone terribly wrong, and you respond without any urgency, both in the speed of the response and in the tone of the email, things can go from bad to worse. Relationships are ruined over a lack of empathy. So I guess what I'm saying is, be understanding and be nice. Okay, let's get down to the five steps to write the perfect email. Step one, what is the question they're asking? Step two, what is the question that they're really asking? Remember, you're the expert, you're the specialist. And so the person asking a question of you might not know how to best frame their question, or they might not have the right words. So you have to kind of figure out what their actual goal is in asking the question. And that's what I mean here. Now, at this point, it's time to write your response. But before you hit send, we ask the next questions. Step three. Does my response answer the exact question that they ask? Step four, did I answer the real question? In other words, step four is, did I help them achieve the goal that they were trying to achieve when they wrote in the first place? And step five, does my email look good? This fifth step refers to appropriate punctuation, not using paragraphs that are too long, using their name, adding full stops, basically the basics of letter writing. So let's discuss some examples. Let's say a client writes to you, a web designer, and says, "Hey, I'd like to access my website via FTP so I can upload some images." Now let's go through those steps. Step one, what is the question that they're asking? They're asking how to access their site via FTP. Step two, what are they really asking? What are they trying to achieve? Well, they're trying to upload images to their website. So now we're at the stage of writing our response. We have to make sure that we're keeping their goal in mind. They want to upload images. So step three, after you've written your response, did you tell them how to access their site via FTP? Great. You don't have to answer it in excruciating detail because we know their goal is uploading images. So step four is, did you tell them an easy, clear way for them to upload images to their site? Perhaps FTP doesn't even come into it. So that's step three and four. And step five, make sure that the email looks good. If you're giving them steps to uploading their images, did you use a numbered list to walk through the steps rather than squishing all the instructions into one paragraph? Did you greet your clients by name? Are your sentences easy to read, etc.? Let's look at another example. This example comes from my own experience. I remember training someone on customer support, and a customer wrote in and said, "Do you offer A/B testing with your email newsletter platform?" This new customer support agent, who was still in training, just wrote back saying, "No, we don't offer A/B testing, full stop, done." So that violates pretty much everything we've discussed so far. They exhibited no empathy, so the foundation isn't even there. While they answered step one, they answered the direct question, at no point did this agent think about the motivation behind the question, which in this instance was a small business owner wanting to get the most out of their email newsletter. So what they should have done is looked at step two and understood why they were asking this question. They wanted to get the most out of their newsletters. So in steps three and four, this agent should have explained that, no, we don't offer A/B testing, but here's why we don't offer A/B testing. Here's how to A/B test on your own without a specific feature, or better yet, here's ideas to actually optimize your newsletter. And then step five would have obviously been to make sure that the customer name was used in the email, the explanations were clear and easy to read, etc. I think you get the idea. But if you apply this five-step process to almost any customer support interaction, you'll kind of get the idea of why it's so important in email. And I'll give you another example from my own in-person life here in Tel Aviv, where I live. I'm a surfer, and I went to a local surf shop to get a longboard. Longboards are generally much easier to catch smaller waves with. So I went to the local shaper, and I said, "Hey, do you shape longboards?" He said, "No. No, we don't." At that point, he could have written me off. But instead, he asked me why I want a longboard for the local wave. And I told him, well, the waves are small. He explained the problem is the waves are also very steep. And so what's better than a longboard is a short board with a lot of volume. And so he took the time to explain the reasons he doesn't shape longboards, as well as the reasons why he's got a better solution for me. If you apply that to an email, you'll have a far better relationship to the people you're communicating with. And like this local surfboard shaper, you'll make a sale if that's what you're aiming to do. I ended up buying a shortboard, and a couple years later, I still use it almost every week. It was the perfect choice. So to recap, before we get into a lightning round of email tips, let's just run through this five-step process again. Step one, what is the writer actually asking? Step two, what do they really need from you? What is the goal they're trying to achieve? Step three, did your email answer their basic superficial question? Step four, did you help them achieve their goal? And step five, does your email look good? Now those five steps are pretty clear. Let's discuss some simpler tips to make your emails look good and read well. First thing first, say I, not we. When you're communicating with someone as a business, it still is always more meaningful to say, "I think you should do this," rather than "we the business think you should do this." It just helps to relate to people better. Next, try and greet people by name and sign off by name. It helps show a connection, and it also imparts a feeling of personal investment in this communication. If you're trying to set up a time, always suggest the time or use a scheduling tool. When it comes to step two and step four of this five-step process, when you're not sure what they're really asking or if you've really answered their question or helped them achieve their goal, guess. It's totally okay to guess, provided you let the recipient of your email know that you're doing your best to solve their problem, but you're certainly open to elaborating or hearing more about their needs so you can help solve their issues or achieve their goals. Spacing between paragraphs is important. On mobile phones and in many email clients, two sentences can feel like a lot. Three or four sentences feels like a giant body of text. So I often recommend putting a new paragraph spacing after two or three sentences. It helps the recipient parse the information appropriately. When giving instructions, use bullet points or numbered lists. Giving instructions in a paragraph often is really challenging to follow. I've already mentioned this earlier, but punctuation really matters. Use full stops, capitalized at the start of the sentence, it goes a long way to showing your professional bona fides and being easier to read. This tip is one of my favorites. Show your work. Behind the scenes, you've put a lot of thought, effort, and time in helping your colleagues and clients achieve their goals. Help them understand that by explaining your thought process, the work you've done, the things you tried. And my last tip of all, if you need something from your customer or colleague, be clear on what you need. Open-ended endings like please advise tend to be really challenging for someone to actually respond to and get you the information you need. If you need clarification on something, be very clear on what that is. And that's it. Following this five-step process will help you communicate beautifully with everyone you work with. Be empathetic and write with a smile. Cheers.
So there you go. That was a good one, wasn't it?
Yeah, very much up my street.
I thought so.
Yeah. You know, I've listened, and you are one of those people, Paul, who have kind of put down email as kind of archaic and, you know, a thing of the past for years now. And I thought, well, you know, I use email all the time. I think it's really good. And I also agree wholeheartedly with a lot of the things Dean was saying about, you know, clarity, but also the stuff about, you know, just write, you know, write stuff that's nice and, you know, be polite. I can't remember what he had an analogy at the start about. Oh, he was about a waiter, wasn't it?
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, well, yeah. Why do you get one-line emails with no introduction, no thanks, no, and often sort of littered with, you know, not necessarily misspelled words, but, you know, shortenings of words, like it's a text or something. Just write normally.
Oh,
write.
You're sounding so old.
It's true, though.
I know it is. I have to say, I write really grumpy, terse, short emails.
And I haven't why?
Got a, because I've got a... I can't be asked.
Because you're busy, Paul.
I'm
that
busy.
Right, isn't it? Yeah.
I'm too important for the likes of people. Yeah, so I did feel a bit kind of shamed listening to this, because he did make some really good points.
And I always thank people as well. If somebody sends me something, I always say, yeah, thanks for that, or whatever, you know, because I think it's polite. Mm. And it's like, well, you know, aren't you wasting productivity time? But it takes seconds just to go cheers or whatever.
Mm.
It's polite and engaging, I've written here. Yes, exclamation mark.
He also said, I thought, which was a really good line that kind of reinforces that, be empathetic and write with a smile.
Yes.
I liked that. And to be honest, if I'm honest, Dean, I was listening to this as it was playing back, going, meh, meh, email, you know, like, keep it short, get it done. I mean, I see what you mean about customer support, yeah, but general emails now, this doesn't apply, blah, blah, blah. And then it occurred to me that, actually, everything he was saying is the same advice I give about creating a web page, right? Mm-hmm. Did I answer the user's question?
Yep.
Did I help them achieve their goal? Is it well written? Is it written in the first person? Well, you know, we talk about we and not Headscape, for example.
Yep.
Is it empathetic? Does it have personality? And I thought, well, if I'm applying it to web pages, I should apply it to emails really as well, shouldn't I?
Yeah, I also think with emails, because I'll sometimes I'll go back and, you know, check something out for some reason, or I'll search my email for something and find. And if the email thread between me and whoever was written in a way that is, you know, I'll keep it, clarity, thoroughness, if all those things are there, then it's just much easier to kind of find what you're looking for.
Hmm.
So from now on, Paul,
you'll get polite emails. Well, you won't, but everybody else will. It's really funny. I listened to this I listened to it, and already it's really made me change the way I write my emails. So that's quite good. But it is the fact that I do think it's applicable to so much more. It is applicable to web pages, but I also think it's applicable to sales. You know, and perhaps that's why you're better at this, because that's the kind of area that you focus on. Mm. You know, don't just give customers exactly what they say they want, but look at the underlying goal, you know, that's, so that you can offer alternatives,
yeah.
which,
Don't assume that people know what your response is going to mean as well. That's another thing. They might ask you a question, you might reply, and they're none the wiser. And you should be able to kind of like think, is this person likely to understand my response to this? And if the answer to that is no, then you need to explain it.
Mm. And then also there was that bit he talked about, show your work. You know, and I think that applies in sales very much, you know, why we've proposed the solution that we have. And it certainly applies when you're in projects. You know, one of the things I always say is, you know, when you're presenting design, for example, you need to explain the background of it, why you made the decisions you do. And whether that's via email or in person makes no difference. So that's why in some ways I think Dean was selling himself a bit short by just talking about email, because actually I think this applies in any communication in any circumstances, really.
Yep. No argument here. Don't be lazy, people.
I do just have to say, I hate stock answers. You know, when you get customer support and you ask them one question. And I actually wrote back. I wrote to one company where I can't. I will say the company, because screw it, they deserve it. It was PayPal, right?
Oh, right.
I had a question for PayPal. So I wrote them a question, and I started off the email by saying, at face value, this will look like ... But please don't send me a stock answer for that question, because that is not what I am asking. I swear to God that is what I wrote to them, because I dealt with them before. What did I get back? Stock bloody answer.
From a robot.
Yeah.
Probably.
And you just think...
nothing more annoying. I mean, I don't... The emails that come back from... send in a support query or something like that, and you get the email back, you know, we've received your email, but they're often disguised as more than that. Mm. And it's kind of like, don't fluff it up. It's an automated response. Just say, we have received your email, it's in the system, we'll respond within a maximum time of whatever. Anyway, we've kind of gone off the subject a bit.
No, because I think the subject is that email is shit, is what we're saying. It's a bad form of communication, and you just haven't come to terms with that yet.
It's so not. What's a better form of communication than the telephone, Paul?
Oh, yes. But no, let's face it, the telephone is a better form of communication.
Yeah, it is. I'll give you that one.
Actually, if I'm honest, I have no problem with email whatsoever, in theory. So in other words, it's asynchronous, which I like. In other words, it's not like a real time conversation, so people can answer it when they want to.
Yep.
Which is a good thing. It's as long form as you need it to be, which is a good thing. It's easy to follow threaded conversations, unlike in something like Slack where things get kind of disappear and stuff like that. It's got so much going for it. I think where I've been down on it in the past is for two reasons. One is the fact that we now have a new generation of people that, whether we agree with it or not, are not using email, right? You know, if you look at an average millennial, I hate that term, but, you know, if you look at somebody of that kind of age, they don't really use email very much at all. They don't particularly like email. So I've got a problem with it from that point of view. The other reason I've got a problem with it is that it's so many people use it so badly. My problem with email is the fact that people, are allowing it to interrupt them the whole time, that they're not managing it in a very good way, and that when they write email to other people, they're so badly structured. I mean, some of the advice that Dean gave, you know, the whole thing about bullet points and those kinds of stuff, and just, you know, sometimes, okay, yeah, you want a bit of politeness in it and a bit of kind of humanity in it, but, you know, sometimes it's hours of waffle in an email just to get to the frigging point. And Dean was talking about that as well, that you need to kind of be clear and concise, and so many people aren't via email.
Clear and thorough.
But that's not a reflection actually on the platform. That's a reflection on how people use it.
Yeah, and I know what you're saying about millennials, and maybe they don't use email in their kind of daily lives, but then I guess I don't use it that much to kind of, I don't know, talk to my mates or whatever. It's a work tool,
yeah.
I view it as, and I think yes. that no matter how old you are, you're going to be having to use email.
Yeah.
So do it well.
I do think the other problem with email is just is spam, isn't it? You know, you get so much crap coming through that's just frustrating.
Not as bad these days. I think the filters are pretty good.
Yeah, okay, of totally unsolicited stuff, but it is, I get a load, you know, because I sign up to loads of stuff, and, you know, that's it then. They'll email you for the rest of your life.
Yeah, all your family.
But the trouble, I know the other side of it as well. I recently got an email from somebody who said, I won't use the exact words he said, but take me off of your mailing list, but with more expletives in, and said, I never asked to be signed up for this. And I have no idea. He must have, because I've never bought any links. How he got on there is a double opt-in. So he not only somebody couldn't have added him on his behalf. He'd obviously just forgotten he'd added himself years ago. And that's fair enough. I understand that. And the fact that every single one of my emails always has a kind of unsubscribe click, single click at the bottom. So I can see the other side of it as well. They think they're emailing real people that actually care, but a lot of the time they're not.
True.
Anyway. So, yes, thank you, Dean.
Yes, I enjoyed that one, as you can tell.
I won't dwell too much on Dean and who he is, because I'm now about to promote him. He's paying me to promote him. So, you know, there's that. So, as you gather, Dean runs a couple of tools. One is Teacup Analytics, which is built on Google Analytics and helps you actually understand what's going on with Google AdWords and build dashboards for your clients and answer questions and stuff. But what he currently is asking me to promote for him is Teacup AdWords, which is a slightly different thing. And essentially, AdWords helps you build AdWords campaigns, as you would expect. So the thing is that when you create an AdWords campaign, you kind of Google tries to encourage you to create ad groups where it takes, I don't know, 25-ish keywords, and you kind of group them all together and you create an ad for that group of keywords. And you push everybody to the same landing page. But the trouble with that approach is that you're out of that kind of set of keywords. Some will perform much better than others, and it turns into a bit of a headache to manage them all and, you know, work out which ones are working and which ones are not, and, you know, whether you should optimize the landing page for this keyword or that keyword, etc. So the alternative to that is to create ads for a single keyword only. Because that means that you can then be much more targeted, obviously, in your landing page, in the ad itself, and you can still have variations of the keyword. So in other words, you know, you can have, you could pay more to get an exact match for that keyword and slightly less for a phrase match where, you know, it's got both words but not necessarily in the same order, or a broad match, you know, etc. But it's essentially the same keyword. So that means that your landing page and the ad itself can be very specific to that keyword. Of course, the downside of that is it's a lot of effort to do that, right? It'll create much, much better results, but then that's a lot of ads you've got to create and a lot of landing pages. And that's where Teacup AdWords comes in, because it will create all of that for you. And help you build all of that. So it'll build all the landing pages, it'll create all the ads, and it'll also uncover the new keywords related to the one that you're targeting specifically. So, you know, it automates a lot of the process so that you get a better return of investment at the end of the day. So they're currently running a limited beta of this tool, and they're looking for people to sign up for early access to work alongside them. To improve it and make sure it's right. So if that's something you're interested in, you can go to teacupanalytics.com/AdWords. All righty. So now we come on to Megan. Excuse me. Sorry.
Paul's dying in the background. Oh, you weren't very well last week. Are you feeling a bit better?
Yeah, I'm feeling fine now. Good. Which is, you know, a bit man flu. So it's Megan Hartman at craftingcreative.com. And she tells you a little bit about herself in the talk, so I won't say too much otherwise, other than that she's a web design strategist, does all kinds of cool stuff. So you can check her out at craftingcreative.com. Now, she's going to talk about something called the no like trust factor. Whew. Have you heard of that before, Marcus?
I had to look it up.
I'd vaguely heard of it, but I did have to look it up as well.
Yeah.
Apparently, according to Megan, it's ubiquitous.
It
Who knew?
I'm thinking, well, you know, whenever I hear something like that, I think, well, that's just because I'm old. Or lazy, and or lazy. One of the two.
Yeah. So as I understand it, it's a thing that's used quite extensively in the marketing circles. And it's the fact that, you know, a client has to know you, or, you know, a user who's coming to your site has to know you first in order to come to the site, then they have to like you, and then they have to trust you before they're willing to buy, right? Mm-hmm. So it's fairly self-explanatory in the name. But what Megan does is look at how to increase your no like trust factor, which is what she talks about, and there's some really good stuff in it. So let's hand over to her.
If you have an online business, you've probably heard of the ubiquitous no like and trust factor. It's that somewhat vague term that online marketers throw around when they want you to feel like they've got the secret to six-figure success. If you've got a no-like trust factor, then you'll have a wait list of raving wannabe clients and mountains of cash piling up. But they got one thing wrong. The no piece of the no-like and trust factor isn't about your audience knowing you. It's about you knowing them. When they feel like you really get them, then the like and the trust will naturally follow. So how do you do that? I've got 5 tips for you. But first, let me introduce myself. My name is Megan, and I am the web design strategist behind craftingcreative.com, where I work with other creative entrepreneurs to craft websites that convert. So step one for increasing your no like and trust factor is to research your users. First things first, you've got to know your ideal client. A good place to start is with observation, or listen-only mode, as I like to think of it. So you want to observe how people in your target market talk about their problems and desires. You can do this in Facebook groups, on blog comments, in Instagram captions, or on forums like Reddit or Quora. To get a copy of the Google Sheet that I use to track these comments, you can follow the link bit.ly/user-research-sheet. And that's all one word, lowercase. So next, after observation, you want to talk to them however you can. You can ask them questions and listen with blog comments or in Facebook groups. You can send them surveys, or you can have Skype chats. So look for patterns in the way that people describe their struggles and their desires, and use those exact words or phrases in your website copy. I can't emphasize enough just how important this research phase really is. It really is the foundation that will inform every other aspect of your website. So step number 2 is interpret the data. I want you to go beyond what you hear them saying they want, because this is what they think they want. But think about how you can synthesize this research to pull out some grain of truth that they're not fully cognizant of yet, because this is what they really need. So for example, during your research, you find that your ideal client describes herself as an idea person or a visionary. She says her problem is that she lacks follow-through. But then, digging further, you realize that her problem isn't with follow-through. It's with the fact that she's an overachiever. She says yes to every project that comes her way, and then she fizzles out before she can finish any of them. See, now you've struck gold. Now you can describe your ideal client's situation in a way that makes her say, "Yes, you get me." And you can offer her up this aha moment of clarity so that she thinks, "Oh my God, that's so true." So step number 3, once you've elicited those connection-building responses, the next best thing you can do to increase your no-like trust factor is to give generously. because you have to give before you can receive. Some examples of offering value might be your opt-in freebie or content upgrade on your website. You can create detailed or insightful blog posts and tutorials. You can offer free spreadsheets or downloads that don't even require an email address. You can share exclusive content with your email list. You can offer actionable video lessons or podcast tutorials. Whatever it is, just make sure it's something that aligns with what you found your ideal client needs. Step number 4, be specific. Specificity is really the key to success in this business, and I could teach a whole lesson just on being specific, but here's the Cliff's Notes version. You want to be specific with who you serve. You don't just serve anyone. Think about who that person is that you've been researching. Be specific with what you do. Are you a web designer? Or do you specifically design ebooks for people that want to self-publish? Be specific with how you work. Is there a certain process that you always go through? Be specific with your calls to action, your buttons, your links. And be specific with your website copy in general. So when you were doing the research, you were highlighting those key phrases that people were using, and you can use those again in your copy. And be specific with how you describe your ideal client situation. Because if you just say something like, you're feeling overwhelmed or drained, well, overwhelm is a word that looks differently to different people. To one person, when she feels overwhelmed, that might look like she's jumping around from one thing to the next and never finishing anything. To someone else that's overwhelmed, that might look like she just shuts down and she doesn't interact with people and she kind of pulls away from everything. So that's why it's so important to know who your ideal client is so that you can be really specific and detailed in your copy. Then step number 5 is to look legit. You've heard the phrase, fake it till you make it. Well, that's a great confidence-boosting mantra, but it's really a credibility killer on your website. You don't want to fake knowledge or act self-important. I know it seems a bit counterintuitive, but you're actually more trustworthy if you're seen as relatable rather than as a powerful authority figure. So it's crucial to be candid, but you also have to be professional with your website because it is your digital storefront after all. And people buy from people that have gotten real results for other people. So make sure you show off that street cred with some genuine testimonials. So to recap, to increase your know-like trust factor on your website, you've got to show your site visitors that you know them, like really know them. Offer them something super valuable for free. Make sure you're super specific in how you talk to them. And showcase your success stories. And don't forget, if you want to grab a free copy of that Google Sheet that I use when I'm doing the beginning stages of user research, then you can just head to bit.ly/user-research-sheet. And once again, I'm Megan. Thank you for listening.
So I like that.
Yeah, I mean, the reason why I probably didn't know like trust is because I'm not really a marketer.
No.
So I've listened intently and thought, I'm not sure I've got an awful lot to say on this. Other than one thing that she did say was the kind of first step of research, the kind of listen-only bit, where you kind of just go in and read what people are saying about you in Facebook groups and things like that. And I thought, we could do that. Because we dive straight into testing of or surveying, which is all kind of structured stuff, isn't it? We're asking you specific questions, do this or can do you understand this, but just going in and watching, quite like that. I thought maybe that's something that we could do as well.
I quite like that as well. The reason I liked it is because you learn how people express their problems in their own words. That idea I thought was really good, because I mean obviously that's great for copywriting, and most importantly, well, not most importantly, but also importantly, is good for SEO as well, if you can actually frame things in the language that people understand. And then obviously as well, it makes people feel like, you know, you know them and you understand them. And that I thought was very good, the way she turned that no around to being not that they know you, but that you demonstrate that you know them and understand their problems. And that is such a big thing. Especially, you know, for selling, you know, in my situation or our situation of selling our services, you know, clients want to know you understand and get the problems that they're facing. So being able to express that is really, really good, you know, important. I really, you know, agreed with her on that.
Yeah, the thing that came out of the know, like, and trust thing, comparing it to what I or we do, is, yeah, I get that. I need to understand. So, say if I'm responding to a proposal, I need to illustrate that I understand what their issues are, so that we can help solve them for them. I also know that I need to do stuff or write stuff in the proposal that's going to think that this I can trust these guys.
Yeah.
But it's the like bit, isn't it? And that's what pitches are for.
Yes.
It's like, can you? You know, can I work with these people? Do I like them? And I thought, well, all these things, these three things apply very much to what I do as well.
Yeah. Well, I think they apply to most things. They apply to user experience. They apply to, so it's just like the email one,
yeah.
You know, that we had before. You can apply the principles in multiple situations. You know, the other thing that she said, which I so agree with, is that whole thing about giving generously, you know, and putting your, you know, putting stuff out there and showing that you're going the extra mile, not just for clients, but for potential clients or being involved in the community and all of those kinds of things. And with the trustworthy thing as well, when she talked about, you know, being trustworthy is about being candid and relatable, and it's okay to say I don't know or I haven't got the answer in this situation. That brings you back to pitching again, you know.
Yeah,
that is the absolutely most important thing you can do in pitching, is to be willing to say I don't know and not bullshit.
Yeah, don't bullshit, because you'll fall over very quickly.
Yeah. You know, and it's like the example of that really gets on my nerves are people like me, I'll just stop there.
End of. Full stop, moving on. Right, what's the joke?
So people like me that run their own businesses, but they
refer to themselves as we.
Yes.
You got it.
I mean, but I see this all the time. It's like, I was working with a university recently who... You know, they're very small. It's a small university, right? And they do everything they can to cover up that fact. But actually, I'm a great believer in you take what your perceived weakness is and turn it into a positive. Actually, there are a lot of people that would love to attend a small, cozy, intimate university where you actually matter and you're not just another number in a book, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
So, and all of these things that we perceive in ourselves as weaknesses, some other people will perceive as a good thing, and you just need to play off of that and attract those people. So, yeah,
that's a kind of, it's an old fashioned way of dealing with the public. You know, if you're a sole trader, as I don't know, a plumber or whatever, you will, you know. It's kind of drilled into you, I'm sure, or was it in the olden days, that refer to yourself as we because it'll make you seem more important. But we've kind of, because we study customer service so much these days, that kind of thing doesn't, it has the opposite effect.
And also, I think the difference is that there was a, there's no doubt that to some people, there are some people that want to hire a bigger company, right? If you're, if back in the day, if you're trying to attract customers, right, you were limited to attracting customers just in your locality, right? So you couldn't afford to alienate anybody, right? But these days, you can attract customers worldwide. You can work with people all over the world. That means there are no shortage of potential customers out there. And that means it's absolutely okay to be yourself, because there will be enough people out there that want to hire somebody like you. It's like I was speaking at a conference recently and I bombed quite majorly at it, right? And I can't remember whether I talked about it on the show or not. You know, they found me loud and obnoxious and, you know, all the things that I am. You know, those are absolutely valid criticisms, you know. But, and you know, my instant reaction is, oh, then I can't be that anymore. You know, I need to conform. But in truth, there are enough people out there that want to work with someone loud, obnoxious, enthusiastic, over the top, that actually find that appealing. And as long as there are enough people in that audience to do that, then why the hell not? Why be something you're not and be awkward and kind of uncomfortable in that?
Absolutely, Paul. Be yourself. That's the lesson that we want to teach everyone today.
Be a big, big hippie and just be yourself. Or put another way, you can take lessons that you learn about one thing, like email or marketing, and apply them in lots of other fields too.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right, Marcus, do you have a joke for us?
I do. I saw this one on Twitter from Stuart Langridge.
Yes. Oh, Stuart. I haven't spoken to Stuart in a very long time.
Well, it was actually retweeted by Bruce. But anyway, here we go. I like this. Mountains aren't just funny. They're hilarious.
Oh, no. Yeah, that's actually quite good. I do quite like that.
Anyway,
thank you, Stuart and Bruce. Much appreciated. Just to kind of emphasize a point before we wrap up, you remember last week I said we had three slots available and that people would say, oh, it's not worth sending anything in because if there's only three slots available, they'll go so fast. We still have three slots available.
Lee has promised.
I don't care what he's promised. Words are cheap.
Yes, they are. What's that? There's a saying along those lines, isn't there? I can't think of what it is off the top of my head.
Well, there we go. So we'll see. Now we've announced on the podcast, Lee Howes will be submitting a talk.
Yeah, there it is.
And if he doesn't submit a talk, you can send tweets to him at Lee, L-E-I-G-H. Make sure you harass him accordingly. Thank you very much.
Appreciate that a lot.
Yeah, you will do. Yeah, I love it. All right, thank you very much for listening to this week's show. We'll be back in again next week with two more talks. I have no idea what I'll do. See you then. Bye-bye. Bye. Bye.